The Great Australian Lives Podcast with Craig Willis for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.
My guest this week is one of the most travelled people I know. He's also an experienced photographer and has spent much of his life up in the air, usually in command of a sophisticated piece of well-constructed machinery called an aircraft. He started flying at a relatively older age than most aspiring pilots and flew in turboprop aircraft such as the Metroliner and the Saab 340 before joining Ansett Airlines. Following the collapse of Ansett, he headed overseas like many fellow pilots and then landed a job with Emirates Airlines in Dubai, and for many years was the pilot in command of an Airbus 380. He is regarded as one of the country's foremost aviation experts, and it's my pleasure to spend some time with James Nixon.
Overcharge for excess baggage. Know your concourse, know your gate. Up this way, sir. Not that way, sir. Airplane departs gate 68. Please, sir, may I see your ticket, pass, and seat belts? You can't smoke, beverage, anything you'd care for, sir, but we're out of coke.
Boing, boing, 707. Going, going, skywardly, heavenly. Higher than bluebirds fly. Why then, oh, why can't I?
James Nixon, welcome to Great Australian Lives. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure, Craig. How are you?
I'm well, my friend. Let's look back on your career. When did flying become part of your life?
I can take you to the spot at Essendon Airport when I was six and picking up my dad at the airport on a cold winter's day. These pilots walked in from the aeroplane with suntans, gold bars and nav bags, and I thought, that's me.
It's a big step from that to becoming an airline pilot, though.
Yeah, it's a long road. Long road. I was inspired by a teacher in first form who had been a pilot in Catalina flying boats in the Second World War. He inspired me, gave me the dream to fly. A couple of years later, a science teacher told me I was too stupid and stole my dream, because by not being able to continue on science, that meant I couldn't do physics. That meant I could never be a pilot.
Were the criteria at school as strict as they are today? Because I was hopeless at science. I'd had no understanding of mathematics. Therefore, physics would have been well beyond me. So my chances of doing anything like that were exceedingly remote. But are those subjects still taught like that? We're looking for pilots, but are they learning those things still in school?
Oh, completely. Yeah, you've got to do maths and physics to be good, to be chosen to be a pilot, which is bit crazy, because I found out when I was 26 and I had my own businesses by that stage, that if you walk into a flying school and say, I want to learn how to fly, here's some money, guess what? They give you a book that teaches you all of that, and you become an airline pilot without having to do any of the physics or maths or chemistry.
So when you started flying, obviously in a light aircraft, how many years did it take before you actually became a commercial pilot?
Well, I started at Essendon Airport when I was 26, about 10 years behind all the other guys. Most people start flying when they're about 16. And so I had to do it in a bit of a rush when I decided that that's what I wanted to do for a career. So I was running my own businesses during the day, and at night time I was studying, and I did everything, including about 250 hours flying instruction in 23 months.
And then did you make an application to join an airline?
Yeah, well, I got into Kendall Airlines. Well, firstly, I got into Victorian Airlines, doing aerial photography around Melbourne and also taking Japanese tourists down to the Phillip Island Penguin Parade and back again. And then we would do aerial photography. And then I got into Flinders Island Airlines, based at Essendon Airport and Moorabbin Airport. Flew for Flinders Island Airlines for a while. And then I got into Kendall Airlines, which is now Rex. And I was there for 3.5 years and then became a pilot with Ansett.
And that step up from, let's say, those provincial airlines and Kendall, of course, as you said, now Rex Airlines, which have grown quite dramatically, that step up into a major airline like Ansett, what's that transition like?
It's pretty tough for most people to go straight from the Chieftains and Navajos out in regional Australia. But Kendall Airlines, we were very lucky. Jeff Neat, the flight operations manager, chief pilot, his brother was an Ansett pilot, and he utilised the Ansett training system and manuals at Kendall. So we were taught like an airline, like a proper two-pilot airline. So the step from Kendall's to Ansett was not very great at all, but it is great from the smaller planes straight through to the airline.
And a big change in equipment where you would have been flying jets.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. Everyone wants to fly jets. And, of course, working at Tullamarine Airport, flying turboprops, the Saab 340 and the Metroliner, you see the jets taxiing past and you go, oh, I'd love to do that. But, of course, what we found out when we started flying for jets is the jet flying is done at night time. And so we had the best rosters in the world at Kendall's and Rex. And then all of a sudden you start flying for the airlines for the jet operations and you find yourself doing the horror coming back from Perth at, you know, 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning.
And that, again, is a big adjustment in terms of your rhythm, isn't it, in terms of your body?
Very much so. We were very lucky on the 727 because they had flight engineers. And the flight engineers in Australia had done whole careers in the hangar working night shift before they started flying. So they gave us all the tips and tricks to survive flying overnight and trying to work out how to deal with the jet lag and also trying to deal with, you know, multiple nights in a row of doing the Perth freighter, for example, where you're flying at night time for about 3 nights in a row. And that later transitioned many years later when I wrote a book on sleeping for pilots and cabin crew when I was at Emirates. Because if you don't get to grips with sleeping whenever you need, for as long as you want, you can never handle the life of a ultra-long-haul pilot.
My guest is James Nixon. This is Great Australian Lives. So, James, you're flying with ANSET. You would have seen, a lot of hours and a lot of years there. What are your recollections of the pilot strike?
That happened before I got into ANSET, while I was at Kendall Airlines. So the pilot's dispute happened in 89. And that was, I didn't join ANSET till 92. And it wasn't until 9/11 that ANSET went under. So I had 10 good years at ANSET, 5 of them on the 727, and then 5 of them on the Airbus A320, going from old technology to new technology. And then, of course, after 9/11, there was 23 airlines in the world went broke within about a week. And ANSET was one of them.
A lot of my friends who flew with ANSET when the pilot strike happened ended up flying with airlines like Vietnam Airlines and just went overseas, flying with Swiss Airlines, places like that. It really was a major milestone in Australian aviation, the change that it brought about.
It was, and I was talking to Don Kendall about it when it happened. And he was the most well-read person in aviation matters in the world. And he told me that it was 127 or 128 airlines had started up and gone broke in the first 10 years of deregulation in the United States. And so we were just coming up to that when the pilot dispute happened. That was coming up to deregulation in Australia. So it was going to be a mammoth change anyway. And so I think that's what happened is that the pilots were wanting to try and get their ducks in a row and get better conditions before they knew that deregulation was going to change things. And gee, it changed things all right. So it sent pilots from Australia all over the world, about 1,200 pilots went all around the world. And those guys infected places like Emirates, Vietnam Airlines, Thai, Malaysian Airlines, and even as far as Lufthansa.
And, of course, the demise of ANSET, and in my previous roles, that was the official carrier for the AFL, of course, for many, many years. It was one of the saddest days I can recall.
Oh, yeah, I got stuck in Cairns when it happened, and we fully thought that the administrators had it under control. To wake up in the morning, in fact, they rang at John Fasham, working at Channel 7. He rang me up in the morning at 6:40 and said, we'd like to do an interview with you for Channel 7. I said, great, but I'm in Cairns at the moment. And he said, your airline's going broke. I said, no, it's not. We were told at 2 o'clock this morning it was all going to keep going, but that was a very bad day.
And then they tried Mark 2, and that only lasted a couple of weeks, didn't it?
Well, no, it lasted right till my birthday, the 27th of February. So went from September right through till the last week in February, early March, when they finally pulled the kibosh on that one. ANSET Mark 2 was going to be an all Airbus A320 airline, so they wouldn't let us leave. So all of the Airbus A320 pilots, whereas all of our brethren had gone all around the world getting jobs, we had no chance of leaving until after they let us go, after the ANSET Mark 2 left in the first week in March the following year.
You go from ANSET, you go from A to E, ANSET to Emirates. That's a huge, huge career move. What does that cost you when you need to upgrade your proficiency from one aircraft type to another?
Well, it costs a lot. But there was a long few steps before I got to Emirates. I ended up, after ANSET, couldn't get a job in Australia for Qantas. Virgin didn't even give me a reply to my application. Jetstar hadn't started by that stage. So I spent a year consulting, and then I was offered a job at Air Malta. So I had to get back into the game, and that meant paying for a simulator, paying for an examiner, costing me about $10,000 of my savings, and that made me able to then go over to Air Malta and work a 6-month summer contract, flying to the Greek islands every day. It was quite spectacular work, based in Bristol. And then after that, I went into Vietnam, was in Vietnam Airlines for a year, then moved to their subsidiary, Pacific Airlines. And then 3 months later, they went broke, later to be bought by Jetstar, and found myself stuck in Singapore with nowhere to go. Got a job with Airbus delivering airplanes, and delivered an airplane for a Saudi sheikh. Stayed there for 18 months and eventually got into Emirates in 2006.
You see, people don't realise that the life of an airline pilot, as you've just described, can be a bit like a vagabond or a knight errant for hire.
Yeah, that's right. And once you've been a contract pilot for hire, you don't trust anybody ever again. It was funny because when we'd be in Airbus, those of us who'd been contract pilots, we were very cynical and jaded. So we just went to work every day and expected one day you'd get the boot. But of course, people who'd left their airlines and only gone straight into Emirates, they just thought it was going to be their airline forever. And they were fantastic until COVID, when they fired a lot of pilots during COVID, breaking a few hearts.
Oh, I can imagine. Were you based in Dubai when you were flying for Emirates?
Yes, everyone in Emirates is based in Dubai, and had they been based in Australia, if you could be based in your home country, I'd probably still be flying with them still. But when you're living, they wanted everyone to live in Dubai, and I reckon they've got an accountant somewhere who's worked out what percentage of your salary gets paid back into the Dubai economy, and so they want everyone living and working in the same place.
And a fairly expensive place to live.
Yeah, it's pretty good, although the pilots are treated extremely well in Dubai. They have, in fact, most of the tourism business there realises that the place the pilots of Emirates have built that whole country. So we get lots of discounts and they look after us extremely well. But yes, it's an expensive place to live. But of course, in this job, most of the time you're not home. You're at other places for 24 hours at a time. And all you do when you come home is sleep, really, and then get ready to go again. Ironing shirts, that's what pilots do, sleep and iron shirts.
When you started out with a turboprop aircraft, say a Metroliner or the Saab 340, next thing, you're in command of the most modern aircraft at the time in the world, the Airbus 380. That transition must be something quite amazing.
Certainly was. In fact, 2005, I was at the Paris Air Show with my sheikh purchasing an Airbus A340, and we were sitting in our A320. At the flight line there, and he came into the airplane and said, quick, do you want to come and have a look at the 380? And I said, nah, ugly-looking airplane, I'll never fly it. Well, a few years later, I was on the Airbus A380 fleet. I started in September 2008 when we only had two of them. When I left, we had 93. They've got 123 of them now. Most amazing airplane.
Well, I've met Tim Clark, of course, who's the president of Emirates. He put a lot of faith in the 380. A lot of airlines, of course, are now moving it out of their fleet because it's not as fuel efficient as the A350-900 aircraft of that ilk. But to me, it is still, it's the new queen of the skies, in my humble opinion.
It is. And of course, as Tim Clark has said, it's been the making of Emirates. If it's full downstairs, all the upstairs is profit and vice versa. Emirates is the only airline that can fill them. You know, most airlines who have got rid of them only started with only a handful of them: Thai, Malaysian, Qantas, British Airways, Lufthansa, Air France. They never had many of them, so they never really committed to it, and their marketing could never fill them. Whereas Emirates, their marketing is unbelievable. That stems right back to when they started in 1985. The second year, Sheikh Ahmed asked the manager who'd been running the airline, said, what percentage do we spend on marketing this year? And he said, a percentage, let's say 20%. He said, good, well, we'll spend the same again next year. Not a dollar amount, Craig. So what happens is every year they spend the same percentage. So the more money they spend on advertising and marketing. I flew the A380 over the Melbourne Cup. You may remember that.
Yes, certainly.
In 2010. And to look down and see 200,000 people as we fly over the Melbourne Cup and know that, you know, everyone in the world is watching that. It was just the most amazing company to work for, and they can fill every single A380 they want. So the A380 is very, very efficient. In fact, it's more – I did the numbers recently. It's more efficient than a Toyota Prius if every seat is full.
My guest is James Nixon. This is Great Australian Lives for Tobin Brothers, celebrating lives. James, away from the cockpit, and I'm sure on many occasions in the cockpit, you love photography. How did the love of photography come about?
Yeah, well, I started in motorsport, in rallying, when I was 14, navigating great photographers like Jeff Selton and Bruce Keyes around from press point to press point. And, of course, I found a love for photography, and I learned from those guys. And then later on, when I ran my own businesses, I'd do press releases, and the editors would say, "Have you got any pictures?" So I started taking photos, and I went to lots of press conferences, and one of Melbourne's top old photographers working for one of the newspapers, and I said, "What do I do to become a better photographer?" He said, "Read the Kodak Book of Photography, take 3,000 photos, and come back and see me," which I did. And he looked at my work and said, "Now you're a photographer." So I've been mad about photography ever since.
What about some of the shots you may have been able to take from the cockpit?
Oh, I think, you know, that's the biggest thing. Mrs. Coventry in grade 3B, Canterbury State School, when she said, you know, "You'll never get anywhere if you look out the window like that all the time." Well, guess what? I'm flying over the North Pole, taking a photograph of the actual North Pole. And one way you're looking towards blue and the ice and the cracks in the ice. On the other way, you're looking towards the sun and the cracks in the ice are gold, like someone's poured liquid gold in on the ice. Unbelievable. And all those different times we look out, flying through the northern lights, the aurora borealis, when you're actually flying through it in the airplane, you're taking photos just outside the window. These things, you'll never forget them.
James, you've flown all over the world, apart from Melbourne. What's the one city that you've flown to that you could live in?
Oh, that's tricky because I came back to live in Australia. I could live in them all if they got rid of all the people. I'm sort of allergic now to big cities like London, Paris, Rome. You sort of think you could live one of them forever, or Madrid particularly. But the problem is with all of them, there's like a million extra people in them, particularly in New York in summertime. You know, when you've got people walking in the gutter because the footpath is full in Oxford Street in London, as it is coming up through right now and in the next few months, there's people walking in the gutter because they can't fit 9 people across on the footpath in Oxford Street. Makes you yearn to come to Melbourne, catch the number one tram, and, you know, in the city, walking around the streets on the footpath. It's fantastic here.
James Nixon, it's been a great pleasure to have a chat with you on Great Australian Lives. You've had a great Australian life, and it's good to see that you're still asked to comment on various aviation issues, and we've had a few of those in recent times as well.
Yes, I do a fair bit with TV and trying to put some sense to it. And the reason I do it is because we've got so many people who talk about this who know nothing about the industry and have never been in a big airliner. They may have seen one, but they certainly haven't flown one. And so that's why I usually get on, just to make sure that there's a person talking about it who knows what the industry is about.
Been a great pleasure, James. Thank you for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you, Craig.
We hope you enjoyed this edition of Great Australian Lives. Don't forget you can download the podcast through many platforms, including, of course, the 3MP website or, indeed, the 3MP app.
Overcharge for excess baggage. Know your concourse, know your gate. Up this way, sir, not that way, sir. Airplane departs gate 68. Please, sir, may I see your ticket? Fasten seatbelts. You can't smoke, beverage, anything you'd care for. Sorry, but we're out of coke.
Boing, boing, 707. Going, going, skywardly, heavenly. Higher than bluebirds fly. Why then, oh, why can't I?
Thanks for listening to Great Australian Lives with Craig Willis for Tobin Brothers Funerals, celebrating lives.